Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Get Set Go. Get comprehensive car insurance today at getsetgo.ie.
Dave tells us Shandon Sweets are Bridgestone Award winners. Very good. Maybe Cillian Murphy could stock those sweets in a cinema in Dingle's, as Pat, when it's done up. Cillian and Yvonne are doing that together in Dingle. That'll be a draw for sure. Now, I want to introduce you to Leon Diop, who you know. He grew up in Talla in Dublin, mid-90s to noughties, Leon, isn't it?
That's right.
Irish mother, father from Senegal, and there's a brand new memoir, and he's telling his own story about the family dynamics and class and what it's like growing up in this country of ours as a mixed-race person. He's also one of the founders of the Black and Irish Advocacy Group. This is where most of us would have met him. Very popular podcast. And the book is called Mixed Up, An Irish Boy's Journey to Belonging. And Leon Diop is here with us now. How are you doing?
Good afternoon. Yeah, great. Thanks for having me on.
I love the photograph of you on the cover of the book in the orange dungarees. And what age are you there in that photograph?
I was about 3 or 4. I was always a funky kid. My mum loved dressing me up in some pretty cool clothes. Yeah.
And it stuck with you, the funky sense of dress?
Mostly, you know.
A dip in the teenage years.
trying to fit in. But no, I'd say I'm a funky person without the attire now, you know. I like to be spontaneous and stuff.
And you say in your whole story that to know where you're going, you have to know where you come from and understand the whole thing. That's basically your kind of whole, how many siblings do you have, by the way?
Oh my goodness. If we're counting them all, about 15.
15 siblings, yeah, there's 16 of you.
Yeah,
not from the one mum.
No, of course, no. God, God help her.
Like,
not from the one mum. We've family. I've brothers and sisters in Senegal. Some older, some younger. You can do the maths on that one. And then I've got siblings and half siblings here in Ireland as well. So, there's loads of us. We could feel the guy team.
And
a manager.
And your mum, Rachel, still very much alive. She's a young woman still.
Absolutely, That's, I'm not going to give her age over, online.
But she's book,
a tremendous woman.
Rachel, your mum met dad. They were on holidays with the family.
Yeah, and they came across my dad, and my mum looked at him and said, I'm going to marry that man. And she did in the end.
She tells her own family, this fellow over here.
Yeah,
she's so young.
Love at first sight. Yeah, that's what it turns out to be. And really the rest is history.
What was your dad doing at the time she spotted him in Tenerife?
Oh, goodness gracious. Like, to be honest, if I had to guess, probably working as, like, selling wares on the street and stuff like that.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, more than likely. I don't know. I'd need to go into further detail on that with my mum. She recounts the story of, like, seeing him and saying to her family that she's going to marry that man over there. And they got to know each other, and I came along not too long after.
What did she say about him, or to you about him, that caught her eye? Why was she so taken by him? If he's selling all the trinkets and so on to tourists. So.
Oh, to be honest, you know, if I had to guess, it was probably the tall, dark, and handsome stereotype. Now, unfortunately, I still need to, you know, live up to that, to that image.
Well, you've definitely got the Irish bit.
You know,
maybe
a bit of charm, but like, like my dad was someone who was, like, he was a bit of a character as well, you know, and like he was always able to get a laugh out of people. So,
right.
You know, I'm sure that was something that also, you know, caught her attention.
A good salesman. He was a bit of a renegade and in quite a bit of trouble, wasn't
Unfortunately,
he?
Unfortunately, yeah. He was. So, you know, my mum learned that she was going to be having me and, like, wanted him to come here and stuff like that. And to be honest, he was going to be sent out of Spain. And only that he said, listen, if this plane goes up, no one is coming down. You know, he was not a very, you know...
If this plane is going, who's he talking to?
So he was talking to the officials that were trying to get him back to Senegal.
Oh,
so he was
God.
Furious, and he was like, look, if this plane goes up, no one is coming back down. So he was like, look, I have a letter from someone that wants me to come to Ireland, you know. So they took him off the plane. He got back in touch with my mum and my nanny at the time, and they helped him.
Your nanny was really instrumental.
She was, my life could have been completely different. You know, I could have been in a completely different place. I could have been growing up with completely different parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, my nanny and my mom were really strong characters at that time. You know, to ensure that they wanted to have me and have me grow up here in
Ireland.
In
a stable family,
yeah, in a stable
so
family environment, idea, you know.
She managed to achieve that, didn't she?
She did, yeah. No, so they managed to bring my dad here, and you know, things were, I think, fine mostly at the start, because my nanny was an incredibly strong woman, my nanny Mary. And I think she was able to keep my dad in check, you know, for the early years. But unfortunately, she passed away.
While you were still a baby.
While I was still a baby, yeah. Right. I was a year old. Yeah.
And she was very much the person keeping manners on him, I suppose.
I think
trying
so.
Trying to steer him the right way, because he was working away.
Yeah.
But one of those...
Well, I mean, she was able to ensure that, like, my father was a Muslim man, and for a lot of young people who are born to an Islamic parent, oftentimes they grow up under the Islamic faith.
Yeah.
But my nanny was adamant that I was growing up as a Catholic man in a Catholic country. Right,
yeah. She was the boss.
And then as well, you know, naming, you know, your son as well is obviously a really important cultural thing too. You know, so my nanny was able to name me as well, which was, I think, a sign that she was obviously had a lot of influence over him, or he respected her a lot and wanted to, you know, keep her happy and stuff.
That's interesting. You don't really have many early memories of him, do you, being around?
No, I do. I grew up, he was in the house for a number of years while I was young, you know, and he was someone who was a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde character. Unfortunately, he was someone who had some substance problems, and that would cause him to be a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde type character. You know, if he didn't have a drink or a smoke, he was, you know, he was very moody, very cold, very difficult to get on with. Like, you didn't know kind of what you were going to get from him. Unfortunately, he was also he could be quite volatile and violent, and you know, that was something that for our family caused a lot of anxiety and caused a lot of stress, you know, a lot of worry, especially as a young person, you know. And just the other side of it though was that if you did have a drink and a smoke, then all of a sudden he was, you know, the happiest person in the world. You
was
know
he?
You'd be having
Mr.
a laugh
again.
And I'd have it, you know. So now there's a dynamic here. When he was angry, you know, he'd throw me into a dark room and he'd leave me there. You know, and that was something that I really
when you're very small.
When I was very small, and that you know, to this day I still struggle a little bit with, you know, turning off the light downstairs and running up the stairs. You know,
do you really? Because it's literally a room daytime in the dark, or is it?
Yeah, like my mom had to go to work, and she worked night shift, and like if he was in any type of mood, he would want me kind of just out of the way and just like throw me into a room, lock the door, turn off the light, go sleep, etc. Right, but then on the other side of it, if he was like feeling happy and feeling good and stuff like that, he'd hide in a dark room and jump out and frighten me. Do you know what I mean? So, like, yeah. Do you know what I mean? So that, you know, that dynamic or that dichotomy was something that I've always thought about and stuff like that. You know, so, he was a difficult character to deal with.
And when you
younger.
Say smoke, it's weed you're talking about. Long term effects of cannabis, basically, which is
And like the smell of it. Like I remember when I was a kid, like you know. I remember the smell of it quite seriously, you know, and a very serious incident happened. My mom was very courageous and strong in making sure that he wasn't going to be in the house anymore after he got very violent in one incident.
Yeah.
And got him removed, you know, out of the house. So I'd have to go on visitation whenever I was going to see him. And when I was, that's where, like, the smell of the place in terms of,
really?
Like, weed and stuff like that, was very strong. So these are some memories that I have of him. Subsequently, you know, he moved to France. I learned through eavesdropping on a call with my mom that he had gotten lung cancer, and then he passed away when I was 16.
How long did you know that he had cancer?
I'd say for about 18 months or so.
Right.
Now he was in France at the time.
Yeah. Could you contact him on the phone? Were you in touch with him?
Yeah. Like he'd have to ring my aunt Brenda's house, and my aunt Brenda would then walk down to my house, get us, walk us back up, and stuff like that. And at this time, like, I was disconnected from him, but I was also disconnected from my African heritage, which was really difficult, you know, for me. So I was getting very angry and very frustrated with him, and there was times where I'd be like, I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to go on visitation. You know, I'd be out with friends sometimes, and I could be wanting to show off and stuff like that. And I'm like, lads, watch this. You know, I'd ring him and say, Dad, I hate you. I never want to speak to you again. And then I'd hang up the phone.
In front of people?
In front of people, yeah. Just so that I could, like, show... Like, I was nearly, like, trying to fight back, you know, and show that he didn't have an impact on me, you know. But ultimately, you know, of course he did. Like, he was...
How would he respond when you would do that on a call?
So I'd hang up the phone and I'd be breaking out. I'd be very scared now, to be honest. But then he texted me being like, all right, what he said was, you might not respect your dad, but you have to respect your father or something. And you know, I'd still, you know, have quite negative emotions. Now, he'd never, like, he wouldn't carry it on. Like, he'd let it go if I did see him again the next time.
Okay.
But yeah, like, look, he came from a different culture. Like, I'd go and meet him in the square at times, you know, and he had a very thick accent. So he called Burger King Bugaga King, which, you know, I'm telling, like, him to stop talking because I'm very embarrassed of his accent and stuff. I'm about 10, 11, 12 at this point. And this is something that a lot of young people face when they have parents from different countries. They can, you know, unfortunately be ashamed of their parents' accent or cultural attire and stuff like that, and I certainly was at the time. And that
because you've grown up a true blue dub, and then your dad is from a different heritage.
He's from a different culture. He's from you know a different religion and stuff like that. And like the one memory I have, and I write about it in the book, was that I was waiting for him for visitation 1 to 2 on a Saturday, and we'd be outside McDonald's waiting for him to come up, and he showed up in what I can only describe as a really long, flowy pink dress, right? And I'm like, oh my God, is there any way that, like, you can just not embarrass? Like, it's embarrassing enough as it is for, like, every teenager is embarrassed, you know, by their parents. But for their dad to be showing up to the square in a pink dress, you know, in Tala, do you know what I mean? Like, painting a target on my back, you know? So I think there was
By the way, that it was that's the kind of, I presume, the native dress in Senegal for some occasion.
There was, for the religious faction that he was under, it was, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, so there was two things there. There was growing up in the kind of dysfunctional environment, and that's one thing in and of itself, and then growing up with a parent from a different culture and right, being disconnected from that culture, not really able to understand it.
And when you were embarrassed, I presume you tried to push that part of your heritage away.
Definitely tried to disconnect from it. Leaned more into my Irishness, you know. Like, you know, I was trying to disconnect myself so much from it that at times, like, you know, I take my mom's GHD hair straightener and try and straighten out my afro into a mullet the lads had and stuff like that. And it was just...
Into a mullet?
Into a mullet. Now, can you imagine trying to turn an afro into a mullet is like trying to boil the ocean. Like, it's very, very difficult, you know. So, you know, and the smell in the mornings and stuff like that. But this is, you know... This was me trying to remove myself and, like, trying to disconnect myself from that side of myself, which was, you know, something that I look back on and I wish I hadn't done. I should have loved myself.
You're a teenager, you
know, fully, like, of course. Yeah.
Who from anywhere is going to, but particularly you're trying to fit in this identity that you're not kind of being permitted into. Did you manage to get a mullet, by the way?
I definitely didn't. Now, I tried other things as well now. Like, I dyed my hair blonde at one point. Yeah. And that didn't look too bad. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, it looked pretty cool. Like, I was like, I thought myself as like a young celebrity looking person. But no, I didn't. It didn't pull off in terms of a mullet, no.
When you found out that your dad had died, what was your response to that?
So this would have been when I was 16, and I remember coming into the house and my mum telling me after school, and I became very upset very quickly, and I allowed myself to, well, not that I allowed myself, I cried for about a minute or 1 or 2 minutes.
Okay.
And then I was like, I'm shutting this down. I'm not allowing these feelings to come out. I'm suppressing this, and, like, I'm not going to allow myself to feel this way for someone who had caused me and my family and, you know, my mum so much stress and angst and stuff like that. So... I stopped. I said, no, I'm getting on with life. I went into school the next day. I didn't really talk to people too much about it, you know, at the time. But that was me just kind of, like, suppressing grief. That was going to make its way out one way or another.
Did people in your life
know? I'd let them know, you know, but I told them, like, I was grand and stuff like that. Right. Like, my best friend, Sean, when I was growing up, like, he would have known and stuff like that. You know, but, like, he was a teenager as well. He didn't know how to deal with it. You know, and when I'm there being like, oh, it's grand. I'm not even going to think about it.
He's delighted.
I don't have to, you know, have a difficult conversation here.
How did it come out then in terms of bottled up grief?
Yeah, I mean, bottled up grief often, you know, translates into other negative emotions. You know, it come out in definitely in terms of anger. I found myself getting into like more fights in school and stuff like that. I found myself kind of speaking back to authority a lot in school. Like I ended up being suspended from school about 5 times.
Really?
You know, even though I don't describe myself as a bad kid, but I was definitely troubled with some of the things that were happening to me at the time or happening around me and stuff like that. You know,
What did your mum make of that when you're being suspended?
Yeah, she like, of course, my mum like would have been like disappointed and stuff like that. But my mum, I think, always had faith in me that I was, you know, that I was a good kid. And she has faith in all of us in that sense, you know, that, yeah, you know, it will work out no matter what kind of struggles we go through. But ultimately, you know, like I was getting kind of, I was hanging around with crowds. I was trying to fit in as much as possible. I was disconnecting myself as much as I could, you know, from my African heritage. And that was leading me into very dangerous situations that could have ended up with me either landing in prison, you know, or dead, you know, and for me, that wasn't the route that I wanted to go. So I started having like conversations with myself. I started trying to correct things around my identity and stuff, you know, and I began speaking to myself about my father's death again 10 years after he died when I was 26, mm-hmm, and said, all right, I'm going to give myself an opportunity to really grieve here, you know, because a lot of people, they bottle it up. They never think about it. It will come out in negative ways if you do that. And I decided I'm gonna challenge it. So, you know, I said, I'm going to give myself 30 minutes here. I'm going to allow myself to grieve his death. And I found myself like an hour and a half later, still there on the bed, sobbing, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Like,
unleashed it.
It was relief. It was a very positive feeling. You know, it was like, all right, I'm allowing myself to, you know, grieve the relationship that I would have liked to have had with, you know, well, that any person would like to have with their father in terms, yeah, of like a positive relationship. Now, I am very lucky in that I had a great stepdad step in terms of Mark, you know, who is my dad. But of course, you know, my father was someone that, like anyone, I would have wanted to have a positive relationship with. I would have loved the opportunity to explore my Senegalese heritage and get to understand that more and to learn it through him, you know, and to be able to go with him in terms of, you know, walking the streets with him that he walked when he was a kid and getting, right, to learn about him and stuff.
You mentioned, you know, your mum, because the reason you have so many siblings, isn't it, is because your dad had another family after your mum, but you didn't find out about this until...
Oh, no, he had another, before and after. So he was married to two women at the same time. We only found out when I was like 11, you know, and he just, like, it was just casual conversation, like, oh yeah, I'm going to be going to Senegal to see my other family. And we're like, excuse me, what? And he was like, yeah, like I'm going over, like your brothers and sisters over there. And we were like, hold on a minute, like what do you mean by this? You know,
that's so the way he would break the news. Yeah, yeah. Such so was like, the chaos of his life.
Yeah, you know, so when I found out about this, like at the time I was the eldest, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And then I was finding out that I had older siblings and I was like, well, you know, this is making me feel quite insignificant. And, there was kids that were older than us and younger than us. So you can do the maths on that one, yes, you know.
How do you feel about your dad now?
I feel like I don't hold the same negative emotions anymore. I understand that he was someone that had his troubles and stuff like that, and that caused him to behave in the way that he did. But I'm not going to allow that to impact on my life anymore. I'm not going to live with the regret. And what I'm certainly not going to do is allow my negative relationship with him that was to impede me from exploring my heritage, exploring my roots and stuff like that, and getting to know other family members. You know, something that I did was I associated my half siblings in Dakar with him. And like I blocked them out on, like, they tried to contact me on Facebook and stuff like that. And I decided to unblock them, begin messaging them, talking to them and stuff like that. And then we said we'd meet in Dakar. So that was, getting to meet them was one of the most profound experiences of my life.
When did you do that?
I only did that in April of this year. So it was only, you know, really? six months ago. Yeah, that's it. Now, I'd wanted to do it for a while and we talked about it for a couple, mm-hmm, of years, but it's not as straightforward as you think. Like, so there's no direct flight from Dublin to Dakar, although I might campaign for that in future. You know, but, you know, so I flew into Lisbon where my brother is now living, and the two of us flew together then to Dakar, and we said that we would experience it together. It was something that we said we wanted to do, and, you know, the timings aligned and we were able to do it, you know. And we said we'd explore that car for a couple of days and then we'd go meet our siblings and stuff like that. And it was just like, it was really funny. Like, so me and my brother wanted to impress them. So we dressed up in traditional attire that they would have been wearing.
Okay.
You know,
it seems like a good idea.
Yeah, no, it seemed like a nice idea. Yeah. And we had a wonderful translator, Ibrahim, who was a cousin of Adam, one of Adam's friends. And me, Adam, and the translator met, and we were all wearing traditional attire. And we were waiting for a car to pull up so that they could, like, we thought my brother would be driving a car to pick us up, but he pulled up on a moped with my other brother on the back. And we were like, well, how are the five of us going to travel on this moped? You know, and the other thing was, they were wearing, like, clothes that I'd be wearing here. Like they were wearing a T-shirt and, like, a shirt over it and stuff. So, like, it was...
I love this movie already, by the way.
Like, it was you know, it was hilarious. But, you know, getting to meet them... get to know their lives, you know, because at the end of the day, they had the same dad that we did.
Of course, yeah.
You know, so it was just in a different
context.
Your
dad's funeral, where was he? Where was that and who went?
I have no idea.
Really?
I have no idea. It was in, he died in France. You know.
Buried, cremated?
I don't, to be honest, I don't know. You know,
did, like, they know in Senegal either? No.
I think they were able to repatriate his body, I think is that the word. I hope it is. Yeah. His body back to Senegal, and naturally then very quickly they would have had a burial, but I don't know who was there who spoke at it. What I do know is that he's buried in the holy city of Senegal, which is a place called Touba. And when I thought he was buried in Dakar, and I only found out when I got to Senegal, I was like, look, I'll go to his grave. Where is it? And they were like, oh,
totally.
And I was like, what do you mean, oh? And they're like, oh, so yeah, it's about 200 kilometers inland. It's like a desert climate. It's like 41 degrees there. So yeah, we wouldn't recommend it.
Especially so I said, from Tala. It's not gonna go well.
It's a different climate, you know, to Tala. All right, you know, just as chaotic though. But like,
almost going to his funeral that time, meeting the family and walking the streets that he would have known?
We had a moment together where we were able to, like, say prayers and stuff like that. And, like, I'd be a spiritual person, not in any sort of, like, structured religious sense, but, like, I believe in a higher power. So we were able to say, a prayer together. And I got to meet my dad's older brother. So that was interesting, you know. Yeah. So, you know, very stoic, religious man, you know, that very kind of wise elder look about him and feel to how he speaks. Like, he has very, you know, solemn silences and then will say more, you know. So anyways, now I didn't understand any of it because it wasn't in English. So we had a translator telling us what he was saying.
Yeah.
And my uncle looked at us and was like saying something in Wolof. And the translator turned to us and said, well, basically what your uncle is saying is, it doesn't matter if you're black like him or white like you, we accept you. And I was like, this is hilarious. Like, you know, it was a very full circle moment for me.
Your mum is your hero.
She is.
And she found love again. And that's the other side of the siblings to complete that story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, my mum and stepdad Mark have been together now for years. Like, as long as I can remember now, you know, they got married in 2014. Beautiful ceremony. Oh God, right. I will tell you this story. So thankfully, I was very thankful that my stepdad asked me to be his best man. And I got up and I made this speech and I got very emotional while I was telling it.
Of course.
You know, and I had the microphone and I was like sobbing, crying and stuff like that. And I know there's people at home kind of cringing when I'm going to say this next bit. But I was crying, I got very emotional. And at the end of the speech, like, you know, I said, you know, love you, Dad. Like, gave my dad a hug. And then one of the hotel staff came up to collect the microphone and I thought she was coming to give me a hug. So I just wrapped my arms around her. And I was like, wait, who is this? Like, do you know what I mean? And like, then I handed her the microphone. I was like, oh, this is the, you know, what a buzz kill of a moment. Yeah, into this woman's shoulder. Like, I was like, oh God, like, this is the worst thing ever.
But she deserved it. She picked a bad moment.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, what a moment to collect the microphone. Like, just wait 5 minutes.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, like, and my younger sisters now, Holly, Rhea, Chloe and Jade, like, they're all incredible people. Like, I think Chloe's going to be an author when she's older. Jade, Rhea and Holly are all champion dancers and stuff like that. Like, really? They've represented Ireland in ballroom, which is, you know, it's just incredible. you know.
And your conclusion, really, having rejected the African side of your heritage, tried to come into the Irishness, which would have worked because you kind of marry them two in the end, don't you? You don't have to be the one thing.
I definitely reconcile it. I spent a lot of my life thinking that I'm, you know, half and half or one or the other. And ultimately what I was saying to myself is I'm not enough of anything, you know. And I was able to have conversations in my mind where I'm asking myself, well, why can't I be both, you know? So that very quickly turns into me saying, well, no, I'm not half and half, I'm both. So I go from being half of one thing to four things. to two things.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's that, the more that, the merrier, isn't it?
It is. You know, it's that exponential growth in my identity and stuff like that, which was great, you know, and I'm able to, you know, take part in and like look into my Irish history and heritage and, you know, equally with my Senegalese heritage as well. Which
and
is
life
a great
is
thing.
Good.
Life is wonderful. Yeah, no, it's good. I've gotten married. I've, you know, managed to get the house of a wonderful wife. And she's definitely helped me on this journey in terms of finding my identity as well. So shout out to Katie as well.
Katie, you have the house, the wife. What age are you?
31.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tips in the next book for all of us yeah. to do life quickly.
We'll try.
I want to give a mess. Sharon says she's the owner of two pugs in Galway. So all the best to you. Keep up the good fight. Love your pugs and your pug videos. And now she can love the book as well. Mixed Up, An Irish Boy's Journey to Belonging by Leon Diop. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having
Slán.
Me.
Slán.
From the North, text studio, followed by your message to 80889.